Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 358.
This week on the podcast, we shouldn't have to say this, but you don't sacrifice the nation's children to save the stock market.
And a Florida man becomes the 15,000th person to get coronavirus in a single day.
Plus, SCOTUS would rather have the president have no immunity, but also no consequences.
And Senate Democratic candidates are outraising Democratic presidential candidates.
It would have been really nice to know before the Kentucky primary that Ann Coulter would be supporting Amy McGrath.
And perhaps Trump aced his cognitive test this week because he employed the same strategy he used to take his SATs, hiring somebody else to do it for him.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Yeah.
So before we get into the news this week,
yes,
a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
One, you're not going to hear us talk too much about the task forces, the infamous task forces.
Not today, you're not.
Not today, but we're going to do a special episode on Wednesday or Thursday to address those in depth because we wanted to address them in depth because we have thoughts about the task
forces. We have thoughts. There's six task forces. There's a lot of information to dig through. We want to figure out really what the key takeaways from all of them are. And if you've heard us rant about the task forces before, you know that we could do it for an entire episode. So
that's right.
We're going to do the news separately.
Right.
And then we're going to tell you about the task forces in a rant that will be midweek that you can't miss.
An informative rant, because
informative
you too probably want to understand what the deal was with those task forces. This was one of our, Brent and I's early election disagreements was about whether the task forces would mean anything.
Yeah. And I finally got there, like I do often when I initially disagree with you. It's just before I've realized that you were right.
That's the method that we approach this podcast with is I say something crazy sounding and Brent is like, no. And then later he agrees, or Brent says something that I hadn't thought of, but is so astoundingly obvious and important that I'm suddenly like, well, wait a minute. And then I pretend it was my idea when it was really his. That's what you can look forward to on the task force special too. But so in any case, we're going to talk about that in a separate episode because that requires some deep digging because we want to, you know, there were task forces that had people that we trust and love on. I got into a Twitter back and forth with Abdul El-Sayed this week over my task force thoughts.
Yeah, on the healthcare one.
But on the healthcare one, but we have some thoughts about the environment one. We have some thoughts about all of them. So stay tuned for that. This was a week where like huge amounts of weird things were trending on Twitter. And that's not really a story that we want to bring you, but it just seemed important to note that the word teal, the color,
was trending on Twitter. I believe yellow was, too.
Oh, and yellow was, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yellow, one of the more obvious colors. Like, teal, I thought maybe something interesting had happened, but, like, yellow.
Yeah.
And then socialist teeth got accidentally picked up by a bunch of bots. Right. Yeah, so Trump bots. And so suddenly, but you would see these tweets that were like, the worst part about socialist teeth is the time, you know, is that they want to take away your freedom. I think it was like a meme that had to do with K-pop or something,
or
so
like,
that was weird.
I feel like it was, or like a cosplay or like a furries thing.
Oh, yeah,
or something.
Maybe it was like a cosplay thing.
It was a weird thing that like turned into a trending thing because of bots, which was hilarious.
There was also the day that Jews was trending on Twitter. And listen, that's never a good sign.
No,
you never want to see the word Jews trending on Twitter. It was because a sports player of some sort had said something. Well, here's what happened. I think it was a football player.
Maybe.
It was somebody who was quoting, it was theoretically a Hitler quote that had come through Louis Farrakhan. Now listen, oftentimes those two sound pretty similar. This time, it also turned out not to be a real Hitler quote, which is like, don't deal with the blowback of quoting Hitler when you haven't even successfully quoted Hitler.
Right.
Like, that doesn't sound good.
Yeah.
In any case, it was not a great moment for either sports, Jews, or Hitler or Farrakhan.
Speaking
Nobody
of sports,
won in that situation.
Sports are a total shit fest right now, too. They like had to cancel like the first MLS game because there were like
Everyone's getting coronavirus.
Two positive coronavirus tests, like literally like right before they were like supposed to play it. Everybody in tennis has coronavirus. It's all sorts of, they're supposed to be
And tennis is supposed to be one where it's safe to play.
I know. And they're supposed to be playing the NBA in Orlando, like the NBA.
Okay. Don't go to Florida. If you take anything away from this podcast, even if it's not news, just let it be the idea that you should not go to Florida right now.
Yeah, or ever. I mean,
avoid Florida as best you can in normal times. But certainly this week, I would say cancel your trip to Florida. Like, if you were already someone who had planned a trip to Florida because you thought, I'm too tough for this Florida, you know, right. I'm tough enough for Florida, I would walk back that thought this week.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I've been having a hard time commenting on... I got into a few Facebook kerfuffles this week. One that was caused by someone medium trolling my own post about the story that we're going to open with. And then I also found myself trying to comment on a few other stories. I don't know why I was on Facebook this week. I'm never on Facebook. I just thought...
A tweet of yours.
Right. This was all Facebook. In an effort to bring more glory to a tweet that I had written that got the most glory any tweet I write has ever gotten, which is with 35 likes or something. I mean, no one follows me on Twitter. But Maxine Waters does, and you, like her, could be hearing all about Medicare for All and various things about disaster victims and healthcare. And also, funny thoughts from Lila Nordstrom, if you followed me on Twitter. But I'm having a real crisis because the T key on my keyboard has stopped working, so I can't type the word Trump. So I'm having to come up, like, all of the... I think I'm going to just settle on calling him 45, because it's better to not use his name anyway. But also, every time I try to type his name, I get umph. And that has caused some confusion about what I'm talking about.
Oh, man.
Having a little bit of a situation with that at the moment. Well, I need a new computer, but also, in some cases, I think this might be a blessing in disguise. Because to not be able to type Trump's name would really... What I would like is for my computer to just reject the name Bloomberg. And I feel like it's given me that gift with Trump this week.
Yeah.
So in any case. Mm-hmm. But we begin with the story that I've been ranting about all week.
Yeah. And you've been ranting about it because it's really at the top of everyone's mind right now. I mean, we're starting with the story because it's an important rant to you, but also it's really sort of like one of the hot button issues in the country right now. So, and it's about kids are going to go back to school in the fall.
Yeah. The CDC released some guidelines about getting kids back to school in the fall. And then Trump basically got on TV and was like, well, school should reopen whether or not they follow these guidelines.
Yeah. And these guidelines are not anything out of what you would probably normally think of anyway. It's sort of like, you know, they're keeping desks 6 feet apart, using cloth face coverings, closing communal areas like dining rooms and playgrounds, installation of physical barriers like sneeze guards where necessary. I think there's also like some guidance on like sharing of things, know, of pencils and whatever, or like any, you know, anything's like that. So they're the types of things that you would sort of like expect to see in the CDC guidelines. Now, obviously, some of those things are going to be hard to do, most specifically the keeping desks 6 feet apart, because like our schools are already wildly underfunded and you've got to have like 70 people in a classroom. So like you can't put them 6 feet apart. Right. 6 feet apart.
And so, that is why Trump decided that these were just too expensive to follow.
Right. Too tough and too expensive.
That's right.
And if people didn't want to follow them, then he just wasn't going to fund them. They weren't going to get money.
Right. No, not if people didn't want to follow them. If people didn't want to open in the absence of being able to follow them.
Right, of course. Right.
And this is where my concerns came in.
Yes.
There are some countries that have opened their schools successfully. Those countries, almost all of them, have case rates that look nothing like what we're talking about here. So keep in mind that the context is that Trump is threatening to cut off school funding. Now, look, he doesn't have the power to do that. He didn't know that. What can you say? The man doesn't know what the federal government does. That's too bad. But we're talking about the president in the midst of this huge surge of the virus, where a majority of states are seeing spikes in numbers, where there are no states where the cases are really decreasing. It's mostly states where they're either staying the same, and those are states that have had surges before.
Well, there aren't states that are decreasing.
Well, exactly.
Except the ones, except New York and New Jersey now at this point.
Well, they're not decreasing. They're just staying steady.
They're staying steady.
But we're talking about states that had huge numbers of death before. So we're talking about exclusively all 50 states being places that would not really be able to meet the guidelines for various reasons to reopen the schools. And so in that context, we're not talking about the context of fucking Norway, where they successfully
had like 11 cases.
had had 11 cases and all stayed home because they all trust the government and all followed guidance. Or even places like Sweden, where when we talk about how it didn't work in Sweden, we're not talking about case rates like what we're seeing in the U.S. We're talking about case rates that are, you know, that are putting the other Nordic countries, you know, out of range of what other Nordic countries are seeing. We're not talking about, right, like what's happening in California right now.
Right.
The president of the United States basically encouraging school systems to open whether or not they can follow safety guidance, and whether and basically saying it would be too expensive to do it, so let's not bother.
Yeah. After he said that, Robert Redfield, the CDC director, because there was a press conference with the task force this week, which was the first time they'd had one in, I think, like 2 or 3 weeks.
In a while, yeah.
Was asked about the school openings, and he said basically that they were going to go back and that they were going to look at doing some revised recommendations and guidance,
yeah,
because as Pence said at that same press conference, he said that the president said today, we don't want the guidance to be too tough, and that's the reason why the next week the CDC is going to be issuing a new set of tools, because they were like, we don't want the guidelines to get in the way of you reopening
the schools.
Oh, God.
Right. We don't want any safety advice to stop you from reopening the schools. And then the CDC kind of backpedaled and was like, we're not reissuing the advice. We're maybe just saying you don't have to follow it.
Right. And we're giving, it's meant to be a guideline. And then they're also like, they're putting out some more papers that are like additional
guidance.
Sort of like,
if you don't want to follow our original guidance, here's other guidance you could follow that's not as good as our original guidance.
Right.
And then Betsy DeVos got on TV like, we still got to reopen the schools. I have opinions about this for a very specific reason. The reason I'm so worked up about this is because I have lived this.
Yeah.
So I know what happens to you when you are a student that gets put back in a dangerous school environment in a rushed situation. I know how traumatizing that is. I know how expensive that is for you later on. And I want to offer some thoughts about that, because I think one thing no one is considering, you know, everyone is going on about how this illness doesn't seem to be that deadly in students. But even at the rates of death that we're talking about for kids, we're still looking at 14,000 kids dying because of coronavirus if we reopen the school. So if every student in America got exposed to coronavirus, 14,000 of them would die of it. And that's not, I don't think, you know, given how, you know, we have millions of students in the schools. 14,000 students might be dying right now of lead exposure in their school environment. So
totally.
I'm not saying that the death rate is necessarily a deal breaker, unfortunately. What I'm saying is that we don't actually know what the long-term consequences of coronavirus are in children.
That's the thing. Or in anyone, but certainly in children, in communities. And that's the
I'm saying two things. One is that adults have to open the schools. It's not just kids that work in schools. It's adults. It's tons of adults. It's thousands of adults. And those are not adults who signed up to do a deadly job. But those are adults that might be doing a deadly job if we reopen the schools in August and September. But also, I know what it is like to go into a school environment that is visibly unsafe and be told, don't worry, it's not, we haven't found anything unsafe yet. And then later find out that we had actually found something unsafe, but we didn't know it at the time.
Yeah.
It turns out that if you live in a country that does not guarantee healthcare, first of all, that has, because of that, high rates of comorbidities that are dangerous comorbidities, not just in adults, but in children, because we have a high rate of diabetes in kids too. Sorry about it.
Yep.
That claims that they're doing it for your own safety, because what the argument you keep hearing is that kids need to return to their routine and kids need, you know, some normalcy, and also adults, the economy can't reopen without schools. And I get that.
That's the only thing that they're caring about, though.
We're doing right now is we are basically saying we don't know or care what the risks are to children. We need the economy to reopen because we need people to go back to school. We're not willing to figure out an alternative that would allow people to continue to not starve to death and have roofs over their head without sending them back into also dangerous work environments. We're going to send a bunch of silent spreaders onto your public transit system so they can get to school. But we don't really care about that. We're not going to be able to have any data about it. We don't care. We're not going to find out. But also, when it turns out it wasn't safe, we're going to make them ask for special funding. We're not going to have any protections for them, because that is what happened to me.
Yep.
They sent me back to school, and all of these arguments were present. They said, ugh, the kids need to return to normalcy. They need their routine back. Let me tell you what didn't feel normal was going to school at ground zero. If you are thinking that it was normal for to send kids back to school when every visual reminder of 9/11 was in three blocks of their school, then you might also wonder whether it's going to feel normal to send kids back to school when there have to be plastic dividers between them.
Right. And they have to wear masks.
And they have to wear masks, and their teachers are wearing face shields, and no one can touch or be anywhere near each other. And every time a 5-year-old wants to hug another 5-year-old, someone screams.
Yep.
Then let me tell you, that's not going to feel normal to the kids. So you're not going to get the supposed benefits of the normal resuming of their routine.
That's going to be terrifying for them.
What you are going to have is millions of school children who return back to dangerous school environments that may have physical health consequences, but will certainly have mental health consequences.
Yep.
And then in 10 years, when that turns out to be the case, you're going to say, sorry, we can't help you. Because that is what it's like to be in America. So it is not the same thing as one person who really got into it was someone who is trolling my post on Facebook right now, who lives in Australia. And Australia has had 107 deaths total of coronavirus.
Yeah.
And he was quoting a bunch of data that kids aren't spreading it back at home. But they don't really have the kind of prevalence here or there that we have here in even the best of cases.
Yeah.
And even in states that are handling it well, New York City just had its first day without a coronavirus death today.
Right.
So
since
we're
like
talking
March 15th or
something, our best performing communities still have people dying every day of coronavirus.
Right.
So we're not talking about what is going on in Australia. We don't know what it's going to be like to spread it to everyone in the U.S. But also, what is it going to be like when, considering that we have much higher rates of the pre-existing conditions that make this more deadly?
Yep.
We know that this is an illness that is more deadly in African-American communities and other communities of color. We also know that those are schools that are most likely to be overcrowded. Those are communities that are most likely lacking the resources to go without childcare. But that is a choice. We can make a different choice in that situation. We can find a way to provide financial support to those families. We don't have to send their kids back to school, to schools that are also more likely to be deadly anyway, because they're more likely to have environmental issues. We're more likely to have lead issues. I mean, you know, when we look at what the last time that the Chicago Teachers Union struck, it was because of school conditions. It was not because of pay.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a situation that isn't really comparable to any of the situations where they've safely reopened the schools.
Yeah.
And we're talking about a government that knows this. And we're talking about a society that is most definitely going to turn its back on those kids once it turns out it wasn't safe.
Yeah, of course.
And I know from experience, because this is exactly what happened to me after 9/11, that it is really hard to undo that decision once you've made it. Once you are in the schools and it turns out they're not safe, it's going to be really hard to close them again.
Well, that's
because
sort of like
you're already going to have gone through the trouble of reopening
and
them.
And that's where we are.
This matters.
That's where we are in the country right now, just in terms of our reopening broadly. I mean, we're seeing it right now. I mean, I think there are a lot of communities who like know that they probably should have a stay-at-home order right now, but they're probably not going to get one because we started reopening. So nobody really has much desire to go backward. And that you're absolutely right. That's going to be the same with schools.
I've literally spent 18 years of my life dealing with the consequences of this exact decision we're being faced with right now. So I think I know from experience.
You do.
That maybe you don't want to make these decisions hastily.
Yeah, and the thing that
someone has to point that out.
Right. The thing that is so insane to me, besides the fact that we know that they can be silent carriers, is that, you know, you mentioned this in terms of like what we don't know about this. It is so early in. It doesn't feel like it because we've all been sitting around, you know, trying to figure out what to do with ourselves like all day, every day since like the beginning of March. But like, you know, when you think back on, you know, like month 4 of the AIDS crisis, like what did we know about AIDS? We didn't know dick about AIDS. You know, and like every single week and every single day, I feel like I'm seeing something on the news that it's sort of like, oh, now we're seeing that this causes blood clotting, like all over the body in ways that we didn't actually know. Yep. It's not just in the lungs.
It affects every organ.
Right. We're also seeing that there might be long-term mental issues because it gets into your brain and people are having like confusion.
We also thought at the beginning that children couldn't get it.
We also thought
that. And then a bunch
of
them
died. Other thing too.
Of a weird illness that was a multi-system inflammatory.
Right, exactly.
Inflammatory
that like presented itself like Kawasaki disease, which is found in children. So there's, I think that we know that we don't know. Yeah. You know?
And we know even less about how this affects kids because we thought they couldn't get it initially, so we weren't researching what was happening in them.
Right. We know that there are known unknowns.
Yeah.
To quote Donald Rumsfeld.
By the way, what happens with developmental health? Because if illness presents itself differently in children than it does in adults pretty often, mm-hmm. which is why for a long time no one was talking about the kids that were exposed to 9/11 because we weren't dying of cancer yet.
Right.
It takes a lot longer for kids to die of cancer than it does for adults who are exposed to the same illness to mm-hmm. die of or same chemicals to die of cancer. That's right. why we weren't dying of cancer. We've started now, so we caught up. But we're talking right now about an illness that because we initially thought it didn't happen to children, we didn't do any research on how it was presenting in kids. Yep. We've only recently discovered that it can be deadly in kids, and we've only recently discovered that we should even be looking at, you know, doing research about how this affects children because of that.
Yeah.
So we do not have the evidence to claim that it is safe to send kids back to school in viral hotspots. And even Betsy DeVos conceded that we shouldn't send kids back to school in viral hotspots. The thing is that the entire of the U.S. right now is a viral hotspot.
Right. I know. She didn't have any answer as to, like, what that meant, like, where that was or, like, how right. how somebody in a viral hotspot, like, might, you know, there was no answer to, like, what people in a viral hotspot should do. You know, there's no guidance for local communities now at this point. They're just, like, broad CDC guidelines.
Also, I want to talk about the countries that have reopened their schools that they keep talking about to compare to the U.S.
Yes.
Because the European countries that have reopened their schools are like Germany, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden.
Yeah.
I want to point out that all of them have socialized healthcare systems, Germany having the least socialized of those systems. But we heard about Germany's initial response to this virus. It was aggressive. They did contact tracing before they even had an outbreak. They had people going around to people who had tested positive. They had health officials going and knocking on their doors and finding out what they needed yeah. and who they had talked to, and then going and talk to those people. We're talking about countries that have a very different kind of health infrastructure than what we have here.
Totally.
So part of the difference that you can still go to a hospital in Sweden and if you have a heart attack and not get coronavirus, which is not the case necessarily here, because our hospitals in a lot of places where a lot of people might get heart attacks, like Yuma, yeah. Arizona, are overloaded with coronavirus cases yeah. right now.
Yeah, totally. Well, and I think also it's interesting. It's because, you know, when you look at those countries too, it also speaks to sort of like our distrust in systems here.
Yeah.
And so besides the fact that they have better health systems there, they also sort of, there's not this like overarching distrust of their government. That's not to say that
right,
some of these people
the
probably, they follow the advice. So that's, you know, it's so funny because like people were talking about how we don't have enough contact tracers here and like blah, blah, blah. But like, to me, on some level, contact tracing, first off, too many people have it for us to be contact tracing them
yeah.
right now anyway. So, like, at some level, like,
and
why bother?
We've opened places that make it impossible to contact trace because once you have restaurants opening, it's like, what does it matter that you're
right.
contact tracing?
And also, you know, when you look at some places, like, you know, from South Korea, some places like that, you know, they were contact traced and then literally quarantined from yeah. the rest of society. Can you imagine in America, someone testing positive for coronavirus and then the government coming to your home and then telling you that you have to go live in a gymnasium with, you know, 100 other people who have coronavirus until you all don't have it anymore before you can go back out into public right now, we would have a civil war here. And I'm not even here to take sides in that civil war, but like,
no.
you know, it's a different beast here for us to just be like, let's just do it like Norway. Like,
well, and
it's
that's
not,
I also
it,
I mean, even with Australia, which I would say is
closer to us than
Norway, comparable to us
yes.
in certain ways. First of all, they have a socialized medical system, so like it's not comparable at all. But that's where this guy who's trolling me is from. So he keeps making arguments about Australia, and
yeah.
I keep having to think about why Australia's situation is so different.
Yeah,
and it's so obvious to me, so I can't articulate it. But like, I think the first thing that you would have to do to reopen the schools is trust everyone to follow the guidance.
Yes.
And we are just not in a place right now where we could do that.
No.
There is no way for us to keep kids safe because you would have individual teachers who don't fucking trust the guidance.
Yep. Totally.
And in various ways, I mean, and for various reasons.
Yeah.
Some of them accurate and some of them appropriate. But, you know, you would have individuals who feel empowered to make decisions about this being a hoax or this being a whatever
totally.
In the schools that you would not be able to do anything about, which means that parents cannot trust that they are sending their kids to a safe environment by reopening the schools.
Yeah.
And schools cannot trust that parents are sending their kids as safe, you know, as safe individuals into their environment.
Right, right. Yeah.
There is no world in which any of us can trust anyone right now to make safe choices about the coronavirus, which we really are in a way that is not true in the rest of the world. We are
yeah.
on our own here.
Yeah.
And to not acknowledge that as you're comparing us to all these countries where they have these various degrees of collective trust in the government is wild, because our problem is not just that we have mismanaged it up until this point, but we're in a place where half of our citizens don't agree there's a problem.
Right.
And the other half are dying.
Yep.
So, like, we cannot reopen huge public institutions into that environment. And I know how important education is. I get it. I am from an entire family of teachers.
Yeah, it's the same. Like,
yep. Education, Brent and I are from educator families. So it is not that we do not think that schools are important, and also that public schools are important, and also that the socialization and education that schools provide is not valuable to kids. We are not advocating that everyone become homeschoolers.
No.
Because that's a bunch of nonsense. It is just that, like, sometimes it is better to prevent people from facing, you know, misery and death than it is to insist that they show up at school for this education, because it's, you can't be educated if you're dead.
That's it.
It doesn't matter if we socialized and educated you if you're dead. And
that's
also
it.
We don't want to end up as a society. This is going to be a tremendously expensive crisis to deal with. We don't want to create a long-term situation where people have to suffer horrifying financial and health consequences because we were irresponsible about how we reopened.
Yep.
Because the thing that I also think, there's the last point I will make, is that it is different to sentence people to long-term illness in America than it is anywhere else in the world, because it is sentencing them to bankruptcy too. So you cannot say that it is the same to take a little bit of a risk and reopen the schools in Germany and, you know, and then, you know, sort of assume that some people may get sick and some people may have long-term health consequences, as it is here, where here, not only will they suffer for the rest of their lives, but they will also likely financially suffer the rest of their lives. It's going to take away their stability in more ways than one.
Yeah.
And we have no system to set up to solve that. Joe Biden is not proposing to solve that. Donald Trump is not proposing to solve that. No one is proposing to solve that. More on that in our special on the task forces.
Right, exactly.
But because of that, we really can't make this decision lightly.
Yeah.
In any case, that is a...
That's the podcast. No, it's
That's
not.
That's the podcast. No.
It's not.
One of the reasons that we're worked up about this week is because the very week that we started talking about reopening the schools was also a week where we set records across the board for new cases.
Yeah, and we're going to continue to do so. I mean, you know, the R number isn't anywhere near one right now. So it's like continues to go up. And, like, you know, I keep saying, remember when we were at 35,000 and Fauci was like, we're going to get to 100,000. And everybody was like, you're insane. It's doubled since then. And I believe
we're
that
was 71,000.
Yeah, that was two
new cases daily.
Yeah, I believe that was only 2 weeks ago. It might have been 3 weeks ago, but we've doubled our cases very quickly here.
Yep.
And then we had 66,000 recently, and that, according to the World Health Organization, was 29% of the 230,000 that were reported globally. So we're accounting for almost a third. Yeah.
Of the world's new cases.
Of the world's new cases.
Keep in mind that the world has 7 billion people in it, and we have 300,000 people here. We're not 30% of the world's population, is my point.
Right.
Not even close.
Yeah.
Not even in the ballpark of 30% of the world's population.
No.
I know we think we're 100%
Wait,
of the world's 300, population.
300,000 people? Wait, what?
300 million. We have 300 million people here in the U.S.
Yeah,
there
are
7 billion people in the world.
In the world. Right.
So to be 30% of the world's new cases, especially considering that this is a virus that started in Asia, where 2 billion of those 7 billion people live, is not a great look for us.
No, it's
all
not.
I'm saying.
Certainly not a great look for Florida either, because they, like, shattered the single-day record for any state, including New York here. They had 15,299 COVID cases. This was, I think, over the weekend. I think it was yesterday, I want to say.
Yeah.
But that is the most by any state since this began, and it's also the most by 3,700 also.
Yeah.
So it was like they shattered it. I mean, they really
At the height of the virus, New York was having, like, 12,500 new cases.
Yeah.
Or at the height of the crisis there.
Right. And they also had their most fatalities this last week. They had almost 500, and that is inching back up right now. And look for more of that also, because
I was going to say, first of all, that number is only going to keep going up in Florida, because their new case rates are going up every day, so the fatality numbers are going to keep climbing.
Well, that's the thing, and you know, there's been a lot of talk about this too, and you know, you and I were talking about it ourselves earlier, just in terms of how many people have died in California compared to how many people did die in New York. But you know, we learn more about this every single day, and we also have. So, you know, there's still not necessarily treatment for this, but there are certainly protocols when you go into the hospital. Like, doctors are just getting better at sort of taking care of people who have this.
People are getting better at early interventions, because part of it is just, if you don't know what's happening and then you suddenly wait until everyone's dead and you haven't had any interventions, it's much more deadly than if somebody notices that you're suffering before it gets to the point where you can't be resuscitated. Right.
But I think a lot of people were sort of like looking at the deaths lately, which had mostly flatlined and or even gone down sort of like really over the last kind of like month, 6 weeks. But now that we are seeing these cases take off, we're going to start seeing more deaths, but they're not going to come for a while, because we know that the deaths are is a lagging indicator, because you don't see somebody die until at least 2 weeks, probably after they've tested positive, unless they've tested positive like once they've already become, you know, they've already gone into the hospital. But most of these people are being tested and don't know that they have it at the time, or like very early, like they just have a cough, so they go to get tested. So you're not going to see these numbers, these case numbers that have sort of like doubled in the last 2 weeks, you're not going to see probably for at least another 2 weeks or 3 weeks or even potentially a month the death rate climb because of these cases. So the fact that Florida already had its deadliest week last week, and they hadn't, I mean, the cases had been going up, but it's only going to get deadlier in Florida and probably throughout the country, because, you know, something like 33 states, I think, had like their worst week last week or something like that.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Disneyland reopens.
So. Oh, yeah. In Florida. Sure. Like, why not? Right.
Or Disney World. That's the world one, right?
Disney World.
I should know
Disney
this,
World. Disneyland is here.
I'll tell you why. Because we live in Southern California, where one of the Disneys is.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Let me tell you, I don't know the answer to this.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's continuing down the track of reopening. I actually work with someone who is based in Florida, who just reports every week that everything is back to normal in Florida. It's just like they're just having more cases and no one's doing anything about it. So that explains why this is happening.
Yeah. Well, and I think the thing that we can finally see from this too, because for a while you were sort of having like, you know, just anecdotal evidence of like, oh, maybe it went up after Memorial Day weekend, or maybe it went up, you know, because of some protesting, even though there were a lot of, you know, evidence that things didn't go up, but also it's sort of hard to track whether it did or not. I mean, I think we would be delusional to insist that no cases came from that.
Right.
But I think because it has now been ongoing week on week on week, it's fairly easy to now have the evidence to be like, it's because we opened too early, which I think is what everyone knew anyway, but I think people were looking for scapegoats. You know, I think people, Republicans were looking to blame it on, you know, the protesters, and, you know, the left was sort of looking to blame it on people, you know, not wearing masks, which is more accurate, like, because that not wearing masks is a way that you're going to pass this. But everybody was sort of like looking for a boogeyman, but the boogeyman was America reopening its economy. Yeah.
It's like frustrating, because so many moments in this crisis have been created by people deciding to believe something other than common sense. Right. Like, I think about the mask thing. I was talking about this earlier, where one thing that I get very frustrated about with doctors and people in the medical community, actually, is that oftentimes they're hesitant to make common sense assertions, worried that they will kind of, you know, it'll reflect badly on them as professionals. When it comes to sort of health protocols, at times they really need to be more proactive. So that was why early on you saw so many doctors agree with the guidance that masks didn't work, because there wasn't any data showing they worked. But the thing is, common sense data made clear that they probably helped. They didn't hurt. And doctors were very hesitant to use common sense data because the data didn't show anything.
Yeah.
And because of that, they weren't able to act proactively at a time where, look, the data was inconclusive was the problem. But when you say the data is inconclusive as a doctor, it sounds to people like you're saying there is no data.
Yep.
And I don't think that was the right thing to pursue in this situation. I have spent a long time. I've served on a federal advisory council that is for the World Trade Center Health Program, where I am a community rep on a panel of doctors. And I'm often there to argue, look, we can't wait for the science to catch up with us, because we're going to be dead when the science catches up with us. And the whole point of this program is to treat us while we're alive. So sometimes we have to be willing to look at likely outcomes as opposed to, you know, research outcomes.
Well, and doctors
never want to agree with that. But that is what, like, the same thing with the economy, I think we're seeing a similar thing with the economy, where we are not using our common sense brain, we're using our economist brain to be like, the economy has to reopen. And instead of privileging common sense ideas about what is and is not safe, we're privileging academic ideas about what could and could not be safe based on the needs of the economy. And that's sort of like what the doctors did with the masks, where it's like, we're waiting for data to show us that we shouldn't be doing something that common sense tells us we shouldn't
be doing. Right, common sense that we should be doing. And also, like, to a certain degree, we do have the evidence, even though this is, like, a novel coronavirus, but we know that in other types of illnesses like this, mask wearing has been the thing that has really helped in so many cases, because, and this is why you see this in Asia, because this is a very similar to a SARS-like virus, and that's why they're all mask-wearing cultures over there. And also, didn't have, granted, this started in China, so, like, they had some issues, but for part of the reason why some of the, you know, Japan did not have an issue with this. Right. Everybody in Japan's
walking
around.
Certainly nothing like what we're seeing in Europe and in America, where
and they're all wandering around
cared about
masks
their right to walk around
Japan.
Coughing on everyone. Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. I mean, I think besides the fact that there was just common sense, there probably was enough evidence, but you're right, they treat it, you know, they're taught to treat things in a certain way where you look for evidence for a specific thing, and I get that, but you're absolutely right. It's like,
crisis,
probably,
you can't think that
I also think, and nobody would ever say this, but I think that in part, we were, as a country, in such a disastrous place with masks for the medical community at the time.
Yeah. No, that's what a lot of this had to...
They just didn't
because
want...
Because I had
they
a conversation...
They didn't want us stealing the masks from them.
I had a conversation at one point with a doctor friend of mine where I was like, I own an N95 mask. Is it better to wear it? And she was like, regular people shouldn't have those. Doctors need those. And I was like, this is a used individual N95 mask that I wear every year during the fire season.
Right.
Can I wear this? Will that help? And she wouldn't tell me whether or not it would help.
Right.
She would just say, regular, you know, civilians shouldn't wear those. They should only be for doctors. And I was like, well, this can't be worn by a doctor because it is a used mask, not in packaging.
Right.
We're talking, it already exists. A lot of people in California have them because of the fires.
Because of the fires.
So it's not, I didn't take it out of the mouth of a doctor. I have had it for years. I'm just asking, does it make sense to wear a mask? And also, this is the mask I have.
Uh-huh.
Will that protect me better than nothing? And, like, could not be told that. And what I think could have been said was, do not buy those masks because doctors need them.
Right.
But you can wear one if you have one. And also, if you don't have one of those, just wear a t-shirt around your mouth.
Right. Yeah,
buy a piece of cloth. Like, if they had just been honest about the problem.
Yeah.
Instead of denying, because the cognitive dissonance of hearing that masks don't help, but doctors need them, was what I think got us into this place in the first place.
I do too. It certainly got Trump into that place.
Yeah. Certainly got Trump to the place. I know, we started as a conversation about the case rates rising because we reopened, and then we got into an argument about masks.
Right.
But,
and Trump finally wore one this week. Looked nothing like the Lone Ranger, you guys.
I know. He promised us he would look like the Lone Ranger. Was he waiting until he could find one with a presidential seal on it? Like, why did he have to have the presidential seal on it?
Right. Did that have to go through, like, a million different rounds of approvals and
probably
a ton of different bureaucracy to, like, even get it screen printed and, like...
I was going to say, like, anyone could make a presidential seal mask. So it seems like there's a factory in China that's probably making those right now.
Yeah.
So I don't know why it took him so long to find one.
Yeah, it's probably the same factory that's making all of his campaign swag also.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, he went to Walter Reed Medical Center to go visit, like, some troops who are in the hospital. So he obviously was just looking for a specific place where it would make... He was looking for a photo op where it would make sense for him to wear a mask. Now, I would contend that any time that he is going outside of the White House would be a good time for him to wear a mask. He obviously disagrees. But, like, I think that he finally felt like, especially, you know, I mean, Texas decided to do a mask order this week. You've got various, you know, Mitch McConnell is telling people to wear masks. I think sort of like the Republican common sense, if there is any, is finally starting to catch up with the rest of America here. And I think that he finally felt like he was actually not helping by continuing to go out in public and not wear it. Now granted,
hilariously,
he still says that you shouldn't do it all the time.
He also chose right now in a pandemic as a time to go visit people in a hospital unnecessarily.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to do that. I'm sure
people are like not allowed to visit their spouses hospitals right now.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Managed to thwart the rules, his lack of rule following all over the place.
Nobody, they didn't want to see him, obviously. No. Nobody wants to see anybody if you're in the hospital right now.
No.
Or in the world. Every time a person walks by me, I'm like, get away from me.
Certainly not someone who's had more known contact with coronavirus cases than any other person on earth besides Bolsonaro.
I know.
So,
yeah.
But yeah, we have mask orders now in 20 states.
Yeah.
But Arizona and Florida.
Nope.
Nothing going on.
Nope.
Trump was having a big week anyway, though, because he also decided, in an effort to distract us from the dramas of coronavirus being as bad as it's ever been, decided to do something flashy like commute Roger Stone's sentence.
It's so crazy.
Roger Stone is a man with a Nixon tattoo on his back.
Yeah.
And that makes him a man who belongs in jail for no reason. Even if he hadn't committed a crime, it just seems like that's the right place.
Yeah.
For
you don't want a person like that on the streets.
No, that's a lunatic person. That's not a person who that's a person who's idolizing a criminal.
Yeah. He was due to go to report to federal prison this week for like 40 months. So Trump had kind of been hinting that he was going to do it. And he's been hinting that he's been going to do it for a while. But I think there were also Stone had like one last appeal recently that like got denied or something like that. So it was like basically to the point where like it was next week. The man was going to prison. So
also, Stone was threatening to release documents related to Donald Trump, which I think was the real reason that this happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And that he even said that at some point. He was just sort of like, you know, because he was asking for this. I mean, he was sort of out there publicly being like, please help me to the president. And he said at one point, I can't remember, but he said that he could have turned on Trump at trial.
Yeah.
So basically,
he could have easily turned on Trump.
Yeah. So he was obviously, that was like a clue to Trump that's like, commute my sentence or else.
Right.
I'll tell people what I know.
Yeah.
We should keep in mind that despite all of the times that President Trump has called this a witch hunt and, you know, a hoax of the far left and its allies and the media perpetuated for years in an attempt to undermine the Trump presidency, you know, Roger Stone was convicted on like 7 counts of things, you know, federal, you know, like lying, witness tampering. I mean, all sorts of things. And he was like legally
obstruction
convicted of these things.
Right.
You know, there was no witch hunt here. These were
He's
things.
He's a man who committed multiple crimes.
Right. Exactly. And was convicted of them in a court of law.
Yeah.
So he is a felon.
That's right.
Yeah.
He's a felon, and most Republicans, aside from Mitt Romney and for some reason Pat Toomey, just don't seem to care.
Yeah.
Why is Pat Toomey involved?
Yeah, that was...
Is Pat Toomey in a race that he doesn't want to be in or something?
I don't know. It was very weird, because I saw some headline where it was like, you know, only 2 Republicans so far come out, and I was like, oh, it's Romney and Murkowski, or maybe Susan Collins is trying to save herself in Maine or something like that. And it was like Pat Toomey, and I was like, huh?
Do you think that there's going to be a rash of Republicans who are not going to be up this year but are going to be up in a few years, suddenly, as the tide starts turning, distancing themselves from Trump?
Well, I do think it would be...
Because they want to say they were early on the right side of history.
I think you might be right, because, you know, we've talked about this a million different times in regards to the people who are running this year. And, like, look, I get that maybe it's hard to do this year because you still want Trump's base to vote for you because he himself is on the ballot. So, like, if you're Cory Gardner, it's sort of like a hard needle to thread because you want you know, you want some moderates to vote for you because you need them in Colorado, but you also sort of, like, need all Republicans to vote for you. And so, therefore, like, you still, right. you can't completely denounce Trump. But yep. you're right. Some of these people, assuming that Trump doesn't win re-election, which I think sort of a lot of people are sort of starting right. to
in
assume
2 years,
right
it
now.
It could be a very different scene.
Yes, you don't want, and also we saw what happened to John Bolton on all sides when he came out after it would have helped. I think that there's going to be Republicans who, a lot of Republicans after Trump loses in November, hopefully anyway, are going to come out and be like, oh, thank God, we knew this guy was a fucking terrible right. monster. And then it's going to be too late because, you know, it's like, well, where were you for 4 fucking years? Exactly. So I think you're absolutely right. It would behoove them to do it now to save themselves later.
Yeah.
Doing it now to save yourself now might be hard. But you're right. right. The
but
2022.
That's going to be a very different race if Trump is not elected.
Yes.
It's going to, because there's two outcomes also. It's a risk because if he wins again, we're going to live in a fascist society and you're going to have to pledge absolute loyalty. And he's probably going to murder you if you didn't support him.
right.
But if he doesn't win, you're going to have to pretend you were never on board.
Yes.
And you're going to try to gaslight everyone into not remembering all the times that you went along with him.
That's right.
And that is going to be complicated if you haven't, if you don't have anything to say, well, I took a stand about this.
Right.
Like Pat Toomey right now can say he took a stand about this.
Yes.
Can't say anything else.
Yeah, it's a garbage stance
it's
to
a garbage
do
stance.
Like 4 years into the presidency.
But I spoke up against blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Like if you have no thing that you can pretend to have spoken up about at any time during the Trump presidency to have resisted this,
yeah.
you're going to have, you're going to look like a, you know, like a real fool.
That's right. That's it. That's the word. A fool. Oh, man.
We had some interesting SCOTUS rulings this week.
Wild.
That seemed like a really great thing at the time and then seemed less great once we read into them.
Right.
Which is
I know.
So often the case with
I know. It's
people.
Like I got so many. I woke up to so many texts from various different people
oh my
that
God.
Morning. That it was just sort of like
Trump's tax returns.
Right, they have to go to the city or the state of New York or whoever was, you know, like whoever was trying to get their hands on that. And then, like, you know, an hour later, it's like, well.
Right, unclear. So there were two cases that they issued rulings on. One was that case where Cy Vance Jr., the Manhattan DA, has had this probe going on where he's trying to conduct, you know, a probe into Trump's businesses, and Trump's attorneys keep saying they're immune from criminal subpoenas while he's in office. And they ruled that that's not true. They're
right.
not immune from criminal subpoenas while Trump's in office.
Yeah.
But then there was another case where all of those committees requested his tax returns, and they basically said that they were all Democrats who had, you know, ask for his tax returns.
Right.
They said that the courts didn't do enough to examine the previous hearings hadn't done enough to examine whether those Democratic lawmakers actually needed the records as parts of inquiries that were aimed at strengthening laws to combat some of these ills like money laundering and whatever conflicts of interest or, you know, like
right.
that basically they hadn't done their part to prove they needed them.
Right. It's, you can't and just like, you can't just ask for them and then be granted access to them just because you want to dig up for some dirt.
There's some interesting electoral blowback to all of this, actually, because the head of the Ways and Means Committee, Representative Neal, was one of the only committee heads that didn't try to find a way to request Trump's tax returns. And a lot of people think that that committee, because that deals specifically with, you know, with finances,
oh, yeah, yeah.
would have had a real credible cause to get
yeah.
those returns. And so...
And they have been investigating him.
But it was all these other committees. It
right.
was like oversight and, you know, whatever. It was like Maxine Waters was finding
yeah.
a cockamamie reason because Ways and Means would not request the returns. That guy has a primary challenger. And in September, that guy, who was considered an easy win in that seat, might lose his seat over this very issue because he neglected to ask for the tax returns from a committee that would have had actual standing to do that.
Yep.
And I hope he does lose his seat because
Same.
His challenger, he is a young Justice Democrat challenger.
Yeah.
Who's the mayor of Holyoke, who's great. And that guy should replace him. So.
Agreed.
In any case, that was a side note. But all of this just means that there's going to be more court proceedings and we're not going to see those tax returns before the election, which is really Trump's only concern.
Yeah.
Except that he seems mad about it.
I hope everybody continues to attempt to get them, even if it doesn't, even if we don't see them until after November and he loses re-election.
One day we are going to have those tax returns, and it is going to be a day where we have some of the most glorious I told you so's
that
have ever been said by human beings in history. Sure. But we could do that in time to actually stop damage if we were smart about it, you know?
Yep.
Like, at some point, everyone's going to look bad in retrospect. I think about this a lot, actually. This is another thing that I've been thinking about in terms of the schools, where for the people who resisted our calls to investigate the health situation at our school after 9/11 now look like such fools in retrospect. They thought that they were being the real adults in the room, and every document I've read that was from them has seemed like raving lunatics in retrospect. But at the time, they thought they were being like the real like voice of reason in the room. This is all going, like, all of these, everything is going to seem like lunatics once we find out what the deal is actually with Trump. Right, everyone's going to look bad in retrospect.
Yeah, totally.
And they don't have to let themselves look bad in retrospect, but they're just walking right into it.
Yeah. There were some elections this week. We sort of previewed a few of them for you last week, so we've got some updates. There was that wild race where Jeff Van Drew, who used to be the Democrat, switched parties to become a Republican, and then the woman who was already going to be running against him became the, you know, the choice du jour of the DNC, and then Amy Kennedy jumped into the race, and she was sort of like running as the outsider, which was weird for a Kennedy to be having to get up to. Amy Kennedy won, she will be taking on former Democrat Jeff Van Drew in the general,
which is going to be an exciting race because Van Drew is now running as a Republican, and so he is the incumbent, but he was elected under a different
as
party
a Democrat,
banner.
Right.
Yeah. And so there is actually like reason to believe he might lose that seat, but it probably is going to be a close race because he is also an incumbent.
I'm sure it will be. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then unfortunately, Trump Democrat Josh Gottheimer did beat Arati Kreivik. So that's kind of a bummer. But, you know, I don't really think anybody
New Jersey.
Yeah, right. Exactly. There's a few runoff elections on Tuesday in a couple places. I think Texas and Alabama or something. I can't remember all the states. But we'll give you a rundown of any interesting results that come next week on that front. And then also, I think we may have mentioned this last week.
We did.
But we should continue to mention it because
we're going to mention it every week because people are confused.
Well, and I think that this will sort
of
like...
This is a speaking of Kennedys.
Right. And I think this will also sort of like lead into our next story very well because we're going to talk about some of the other Democratic candidates for Senate and who we feel like we can get excited about. One of the people that we actually could get excited about who's running for Senate as a Democrat is Ed Markey, and he's the incumbent. So it's a little confusing for people because progressives aren't used to voting for the old white guy incumbent and having that be the right choice. It's like the whole world is upside down.
Senate here. Primary is upside down.
Yeah.
Joe Kennedy, the kind of upstart young congressman from Massachusetts, decided to jump into that race and primary Markey from the right. But he's positioning himself. He talks as if he thinks he's the progressive choice, but he's not. Ed Markey is the lead sponsor on the Green New Deal.
He's trying to confuse people is what
he's trying to confuse people. Exactly. And so even my own family in Massachusetts was like, oh, we got to find out what to do. And I was like, let me tell you what to do.
Right.
Vote for Ed Markey. You have one of the most progressive members of the Senate. I know he's not flashy like the other progressive members of the Senate, but he's the lead sponsor on the Green New Deal.
Yeah.
He is somebody that you want to keep in the Senate. And tell Joe Kennedy to go fuck himself.
Right. He can be the senator later.
He can be hopefully he's the senator.
Well, I mean, here's the...
Because he's very mediocre.
I agree. Well, in Massachusetts, they can elect progressives. I would say in most places, you could do worse than having Joe Kennedy as your senator.
Sure.
But like right now, like we shouldn't be having to make this choice right now, you know?
No. And the whole thing has been very sneaky because he is definitively running to Ed Markey's right.
Yes.
But he doesn't want to admit it because it's trendy to be on the left right now.
Yeah.
So he's deliberately trying to confuse everyone. He's got all of these endorsements from the House, but there's no reason to primary a progressive member unless you are worried that he's too progressive.
Right. Right.
In which case, don't vote for that guy.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So Massachusetts.
I mean,
vote for Ed Markey.
Anyone can run in any primary they want.
Of course.
Of course, but I don't like when the party apparatus goes and supports somebody specifically just to piss off progressives.
Right, exactly.
Who is, like, not their incumbent.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be supporting anyone, but right, that's not what's happened here.
No, it's not. But speaking of Democratic Senate candidates, they are all starting to release their second quarter fundraising numbers. They haven't had to officially do so yet, so there's a few people who are still outstanding. Like, we haven't heard from John Hickenlooper. We haven't heard from Mark Kelly. But a lot of people have released...
Well, Hickenlooper just won. So.
Well, that's true, yes. Yeah. So we are starting to see some of those numbers come in, and they are massive numbers. I mean, like, massive, massive numbers. Like, some of them are more than some of the Democratic presidential candidates raised, including Joe Biden for one quarter. Yeah. And there is also, just for some context, before we read off all of these numbers for you, in 2018, we all remember Beto O'Rourke, who was like this big, huge fundraising powerhouse. And like that's and ultimately probably why he felt like he could run for president was because he was going to be able to raise all this money. And that Texas Senate race at the time was one of the most expensive races in the country and also sort of like in history. His second quarter fundraising haul was $10 million, which was huge at the time. So just keep that in the back of your mind as we tell you that Amy McGrath raised $17.4 million in Q2. Yeah. That's more than Joe Biden raised in fall of 2019.
And Jamie Harrison, who's running against Lindsey Graham, raised $14 million.
Yeah, that's almost twice as what he raised in quarter one, which was already more than Lindsey Graham raised and had been at the time a record in South Carolina.
Yeah. So he doubled just reset the record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sarah Gideon, who
she's taking on Collins.
Collins, yeah. I don't think that she's actually, I want to say that that primary or that runoff
hasn't happened yet.
But I mean, like, I think everybody seems to think...
she's the kind of DNC chosen...
And I think everybody seems to think that she probably will win. But that's... She raised $9 million. That's $2 million more than she raised in the first quarter. Cal Cunningham, who's running against Tom Tillis in North Carolina, raised $7 million. That's $3 million more, almost doubling his Q1 total. Steve Bullock in Montana, $7.7 million. Teresa Greenfield in Iowa, $6 million.
$6 million in Iowa feels like...
I know.
What a world. Like, we're think some of these states, like Montana and Iowa, are not expensive seats usually.
No. Yeah, totally. Dr. Barbara Bollier, who is is running in Kansas.
Against Kris Kobach?
Right. Well, maybe. I mean, I think people think that he probably will win.
Yeah, the primary is August 4th.
Yeah, that's coming up. But, you know, I think people were hoping that, what's his name, Mike Pompeo would get into that race and then decide that he wasn't going to, and Kris Kobach is running, but everybody hates Kris Kobach. So there's, I think that, like, most, you know, election watchers sort of, like, have Kansas as a toss-up if Kobach wins the primary, but they also just elected a Democratic governor, so, like, I would assume
Kansas
that
is in play.
In a wave election, it's enough in play.
Also,
but she raised
Oh, yeah, go ahead. I was going to say
she raised $3.7 million, which, according to her campaign anyway, is the largest single quarter filing for any candidate, federal or state, in Kansas history.
Yeah.
So those are just some of the numbers. I have a feeling the Hickenlooper and Kelly numbers will probably be big.
Yeah. I'm pleased about this in part because, not because I think any of these fools are great candidates, but because I know that there is an enthusiasm gap in the presidential field.
Yes.
And I was hoping that that enthusiasm gap would not just be a gap in all enthusiasm, but would at least, like, these Senate races give people that feel hopeless about the presidential race a place to deposit their hope.
Yes.
And to stay, to stay involved. Because I literally, like, mentally tune out as soon as I hear presidential news a lot of the time. Like, I'm, like, unable to invest myself in the news about the presidential race.
Yeah.
And I am someone that loves elections.
Right.
But I, like, cannot bring myself to read about what's going on in the presidential race. It's way too depressing. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit.
Right.
But it's like a war of who's mentally competent is all that's going on in it right now. But these Senate numbers are promising because it means that people are investing that money that they lack in enthusiasm for Biden into what I think is a more meaningful place.
I think it's a more meaningful place, too. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this because I had seen these numbers earlier in the week. And I had also, you know, a dear friend of mine on Facebook posted something this week and said, you know, something to the effect of, like, anytime I'm feeling down or depressed, I give money to one of these Senate candidates and then, like, listed off basically all of these people who were sort of, like, in something that, like, could end up being competitive or whatever. And I thought to myself, I like that idea. I'm going to do that. And then I looked at the list of people because I was like, I'm going to pick one of these guys to who's going to get my money right now that I'm going to get excited about. And I glanced at all of them and I did some brief investigation. And then I was like, this is all literally like some variation of like the same person. Like one might be a woman, one might be black, you know, one might be whatever, one's a doctor, you know, I mean, but they're all sort of like the type of corporate Democratic hack that you would expect to end up with. And so then I was depressed all over again. And the reason that I was supposed to be giving money to them was to take me out of my depression that I was in at the time. So it would turn into like a depression cycle. So I thought to myself, how do I decide which of these people that I am going to like and support? And look, I hope they all win. You know, like, I mean, I would like us to take back the Senate. I feel like the world would be a better place if 51 corporate hack Democrats were running the world as opposed to 51 corporate hack Republicans were running the world. Maybe only marginally, but you know,
marginal victories are all we have at the moment.
So I got to thinking, you know, one of the things that we have cared about a lot on this podcast, we've talked about it quite a bit. We wrote a really great blog post about it that you can find on our website, is that campaign finance reform really sort of is going to drive a lot of the things that we are going to want to try to do. And there are some candidates who recognize that. And almost everybody on this list has sworn off corporate PAC money. But you it gets into like a little bit of a fuzzy situation where you can swear off corporate PAC money, but then you take sort of like the Democratic Senate leadership PAC money, which takes corporate money. So you're still sort of like getting backdoor corporate money. So I can't admit to have researched every single one of these candidates to find out who is the best on this. I know most of them have sworn off corporate PAC money. But I also know that at least Steve Bullock in Montana really sort of like got dark money out of Montana politics. And that's a huge part of his platform. It was a big part of his presidential platform. And it was one of the reasons why I was like, well, if I get stuck with one of these moderates, like at the beginning of the presidential primary, I was like, it might as well be Steve Bullock because at least he'll try and get rid of Citizens United. So I guess of the list, just at first blush, I would say like, you know, at least Steve Bullock like wants to get is passionate about ending Citizens United. So maybe donate to him. It's fine to donate to any of these people. But I'm just saying, like, if you're looking at this list, that's if you're a progressive, seems depressing to you. That might be a way to be able to, like, get yourself excited to donate to Steve Bullock. You know, this is a big part of Sarah Gideon's platform. Also, I know that she is also still taking PAC money, like, from the leadership PACs and things like that. But it's she claims that it's an important thing for her, so maybe it's Sarah Gideon. You know, that might be a way for you to be able to get excited about some of these guys instead of just being depressed about 10 people who all look like they're the same person.
Well, that's, I mean, we have argued for years that as much as we go on about a lot of issues, campaign finance reform is really the only issue because nothing is going to happen.
You can't do gun control without getting NRA money out. You can't do healthcare without getting insurance and pharmaceutical money out.
I mean, every issue that we really care about really starts with campaign finance reform. So if you are somebody who is feeling ambivalent about so many of the candidates that are running for re-election in so many of the places. That is one issue where having more people who support meaningful campaign finance changes would actually make all of our lives better and make all of our lives easier and make the rest of this process much easier for us. And so that is definitely something to consider as a standout when you're looking at a list of what seems like just generic people who don't really share your values. Because that, I think, is... That's a valuable place to start. Everything. As a side note to all of this, I have some beef right now with the Warren Democrats. Which is the opposite of what I just. It's basically on a point that's the opposite of what I've just made, which is like, hold your nose and give money to Steve Bullock because he cares about campaign finance reform. There is no need for the Warren Democrats to go around endorsing fucking moderate incumbents. And all week I've been getting fucking emails from them telling me to like donate money to Cory Booker. Like, fuck off. I feel like there is no need for another wing of the Democratic Party that's just going to tell me to vote for moderate hacks. If you are going to start warning Democrats, it is to identify progressive, exciting candidates in races that people might not bring to their, you know, might not get brought to their attention otherwise.
Yep.
All over the nation. There is no need for the Warren Democrats to sully their reputation by supporting, sending out fundraising emails for a bunch of fucking moderate hacks.
Yep.
I don't care if all of them are in the Senate with Liz Warren right now and that she's friends with them.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Like,
or that they ran for president together. Because I think that she that also endorsed John Hickenlooper. I don't know if Warren Democrats did, but I know that she personally had.
I got the email from Warren Democrats about the Hickenlooper. Like, the emails are coming from Warren Democrats.
Yeah.
So if it has the Warren Democrats logo on it, then I feel like this is, like, not helpful to their brand or to the people that supported her to sort of take that brand and use it to marshal support for well-funded candidates who are not sharing our values.
Right.
Now, that is not to say that I didn't think there was a good place for Warren Democrats in the race. I think its place should have been to raise the profile of candidates and races that had really, like, great progressive, especially progressive women or, you know, progressive men of color, you know, LGBT candidates or whatever, like, should have been to raise the profile of some of those candidates and funnel some money to them.
And that's what I think.
If you use Warren Democrats to funnel money to Cory Booker, like, you can lose my number.
Yep.
Because that's, I now just erase all of their emails because I'm too fed up with the idea. Like, our revolution has never sent me an email asking me to support a candidate that, like, does not share the values of our revolution.
Right.
That is why our revolution was valuable.
Well, I think
I get that Warren Democrats was a different thing than our revolution specifically.
Right. Well, and I
but
think
it should not be this thing.
I think, well, I agree with you. I think part of my issue that I had when she announced Warren Democrats and I read exactly what it was, I didn't know exactly what it was.
Well, yeah.
So I think part of my issue
deliberately
with,
vague.
My issue with them is that I certainly don't know what they're up to if they're asking me to get money to Cory Booker. But I also just, like, on top of that, more broadly, have no idea what they think that they're doing.
Well, I thought I was getting it because they went and endorsed a bunch of women in state and local elections.
They did. And they even came for congressional Charles Booker elections, there toward the end.
And they,
and
then they, like, people like Charles Booker,
deal.
Like, they came and endorsed progressives in races that it seemed like would be useful for them to put some spotlight on and put a spotlight on.
Yeah.
But it was only this week or last week when I started getting emails from them that were, like, asking me to support well-funded, non-progressive incumbents in the Senate. And I, or even if they weren't incumbents, well-funded moderates.
Yeah.
And I just, like, I don't understand how that is a helpful thing for them to do.
Yeah.
Like, nobody needs help finding Cory Booker.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, if Cory Booker is not successfully fundraising, it's because Cory Booker is not campaigning well. Like, Cory Booker is literally a fundraising machine.
Right.
I've been to high-dollar fundraisers of Cory
Booker. I was going to say, if Cory Booker is running low on money, I know where he can go to get some.
Exactly. right.
It's his rich friends. It's Big Pharma. It's,
right.
You know,
he is somebody who is already beholden to those people, so why stop taking their money now?
Right, exactly.
That has started to wear on me. So now I'm kind of like, ugh, why does she always do this? She always fucks it up at the end.
I know. So we're mad at the Warren Democrats, but we also have a new list that's come out this week, and it's the Coulter Democrats.
It's wild.
The Ann Coulter Democrats.
Ann Coulter's back, and she is not having Mitch McConnell.
Really not. She
tweeted.
Yeah, go ahead.
The lovely Amy McGrath. Lovely.
Uh-huh.
Is a Marine Corps veteran. The average donation to her campaign is $36. Ann Coulter's a populist now.
Uh-huh.
Mitch McConnell is a broken down old man owned, I think, supposed to by cheap labor lobbyists. Hashtag defeat McConnell.
Right.
She's in favor. She's campaigning for Amy McGrath.
Yeah, she followed. Well, she's campaigning against. She's campaigning against Mitchell, which is the same thing.
Well,
but she followed up because
she said stay home.
Right, because I think people probably she followed up a little bit later with Mitch McConnell is running this year in a close election. All caps. If we do not teach these betraying rhinos a lesson, we will be Charlie Brown with the football for our remaining time on Earth. Kentuckians, stay home on November 3rd. So she doesn't want people voting for Amy McGrath.
The lovely Amy McGrath.
The lovely
Marine
Amy
Corps
McGrath.
Veteran.
Uh-huh. She just wants people not voting for Mitch McConnell.
That first tweet, though, does not paint that picture.
It does not, no.
So Ann Coulter's all over the place on this.
Totally.
But Ann Coulter turning on Mitch McConnell
right.
is a thrill, I right. guess.
But Amy McGrath does really seem like a great first pick to be on the Coulter Democrats list.
I agree. Amy McGrath probably...
She's an Ann Coulter Democrat.
Ann Coulter, she's an Ann Coulter Democrat. She fits the Ann Coulter mold well enough.
Oh, man.
It's a real situation.
Ann Coulter. God, Ann Coulter. Love her.
I know. We haven't been able to get our fill of Ann Coulter because Politicon's
been off I know. And I
moved away.
Still love Ann Coulter. At me. I don't care. She's entertaining, and sometimes that's what I'm looking for, so I don't...
I don't know what to say about
I
that.
I don't know what to tell you.
We've gone and seen her speak at Politicon more times than any of us can.
Oh yeah.
Stay and
always
well, I'm
a delight. And by
that,
delight,
I'm
I mean horror.
A horror.
Show.
Yeah. Yeah. Always it. An entertaining time
yeah.
with Ann Coulter.
Yeah.
Never a comforting time.
No. No. No.
Donald Trump wants you to know that he's aced his cognitive exams. So this is a man
Shockingly.
Whose mental alertness is off the charts. Off the charts. I feel like
big brain.
One of the ways that brain. We have set ourselves up for terrible failure is that the one person who can't be asking questions about Donald Trump's mental state is Joe Biden. And he is currently our only person in a position to do that. The two of them are just trading barbs about which one is mentally alert and cognitively functioning, which is not the point of the debate that you don't want to be asking. You don't want that to be the question that they're asking each other.
No.
You don't want that to be a subject of discussion among the
yeah.
presidential candidates. Like, I know we all thought that W was, like, kind of an idiot, but at no point was there an ongoing discussion about whether or not any of the candidates were mentally fit to take office. And that's
right.
currently where we've landed. We have schoolyard attacks from both candidates
yeah.
bragging about their cognitive state
yeah.
and shit-talking the other one's cognitive
we
state.
Should
that's
re-
what's going on.
We should read exactly what he said because it's hilarious. He said,
yeah,
I aced the test. Biden, should take the exact same test. A very standard test. I took it at Walter Reed Medical Center in front of doctors and they were very surprised. They said, that's an unbelievable thing. Rarely does anyone do what you just did.
By the way, the test he took was the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, which is a 10-minute exam that asks you to identify animals in pictures, draw a clock, and perform basic word recall exercises. Rarely does anyone do what he just did in getting a good score.
Right. I think what they meant
Montreal
is rarely does anyone with such a clear level of cognitive decline
right.
do what you just did. I think
exactly.
is what they meant.
Also, his comment about the perfect score really struck me as like a very Kim Jong-un-esque
oh, yeah,
comment.
Totally.
Like, it's very sort of like fascist dictatory.
I got 110%.
Dictatory. Right. He was also descended from gods and golfed a perfect game in his first try and, you know, got a perfect score on his SATs, maybe because he had someone else take it for him. But the idea of need of like his perfection.
Yeah.
His, you know, it sort of like makes, it sort of endeavors to make him seem godlike.
Yeah.
In a way that I think the North Koreans would really get on board with.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's kind of obsessed with his cognitive state at the moment because everyone was making fun of him about how he couldn't walk down a ramp or drink a cup of water,
mm-hmm.
as you might remember from that Tulsa rally where he spent like 15 minutes going on about it. So I think that is part of why Trump is obsessed. And then, Biden was also asked about this at that press conference talked about or last month. And well, I guess that was sort of the same thing.
Sure.
And asked about whether he'd been tested for cognitive decline and said he's constantly tested. But then he also said, look, all you've got to do is watch me. And I can hardly wait to compare my cognitive capability to the cognitive capability of the man I'm running against. You guys, we have all watched him.
That is
why the questions are out there.
Right. I think.
And also, this is such a low bar.
I know. I think the first debate should be they should do a cognitive test. It should be like a game show.
It should be a game show. It should be instead of moderated by anchors, it should be moderated by therapists.
Yeah.
Just, it'll be like when you're a little kid and they send you to somebody to have you like draw clouds or something. You know?
Yep.
That's why I couldn't go to Hunter, there's a school in New York City that tests you when you're three, and they like 3-year-olds, you can't really test for anything other than drawing stuff or whatever. And so apparently the test is just like pretty dumb. But my mom tried to apply when I was 4, and they, instead of saying you didn't, you know, you haven't taken the test, so you can't, they just sent a rejection letter. So we've been telling that story for years. But I feel like what they need is the kind of people that conduct that cognitive test for 3-year-olds to get them into Hunter.
Yeah.
But for the presidents. So maybe they can moderate the debate.
Yeah, I like it.
And in final news, a tell-all is coming that we're all going to read. And don't, this time, buy the book. Don't do the Bolton thing where you get a free copy because you don't want to give, put money in his pocket.
Yeah.
Mary Trump's book.
His niece.
Is the tell-all, his niece, is the tell-all we've all been waiting for.
Right, and this had been delayed, I think, right?
It had been delayed when there were some court challenges. Yeah, right. Uncle or somebody tried to challenge it in the courts, one of the Trumps. But it has some explosive claims, including that Trump paid someone to take his SATs.
Of course he did.
Here's another thing that I want to talk about that I had actually forgotten about that I learned recently at a trivia game, which is Trump constantly says he went to Wharton, and that's to confuse us and make us think he has a master's degree when in fact he does not, because Wharton is mostly associated with the business school. He was in the undergrad business program at Wharton, but also he did his first 2 years at Fordham and then transferred to UPenn. So he's also not, like, been hanging out in the Ivies his whole time. Like, he basically paid someone to take his SATs, went to Fordham for 2 years until somebody could make a phone call to get him into Penn.
Right.
Because it was Mary Trump's father, Fred Jr., who had to call Penn to get Donald in. So that was all a scam anyway, the kind of scam that rich people
are obviously up to, because we know that they're up to this.
She also claims that he's commented on her breasts before in the 90s.
Of course she has.
He saw her in a swimsuit and said, "Holy shit, Mary, you're stacked."
I mean, we know what he's said about Ivanka.
Yeah. Well, we also know that he's basically got a list of women who wouldn't go out with him that he hates. And that includes Madonna and Katarina Witt. That's right. Just my favorite.
So good, yeah.
90s figure skater Katarina Witt would not go out with Donald Trump. Apparently, Marianne, the former judge, his sister, is a major source in the book. Because even though she usually kind of is in the fold with Donald and Klan. Mary Trump thanks her specifically in the book and says that she knew where the bodies were buried and that her and her siblings had buried them together. But that she was... that she thanks her for all the enlightening information.
Love it.
In any case, he also once told Melania that Mary Trump was on drugs. Apparently, he really likes a redemption story. And so he, like, wanted her to have a redemption story. So she was supposed to write his second Art of the Deal book and then got fired from the project. And then when she first met Melania, back when he was still married to Marla Maples or whatever, he said that she had her own back from the brink redemption story and then said, "You dropped out of college, right? It was really bad for a while. And then she started doing drugs." But Mary was like, "I did not ever start doing drugs. He just really likes a redemption story." But also, my favorite part of all of this is their shitty Christmas gifts.
Oh, that's not surprising at all.
1 year they gave Mary a single gold lamé shoe that had a heel filled with hard candy. And then at some point, Donald saw her with it and asked, "What is that?" And she was like, "It's your present. It's a present from you." Then in 1977, when she was 12, they gave her a $12 pack of underwear, him and Ivana, for Christmas.
And a leather-bound journal, which was 2 years
old. Her brother got a leather-bound journal that was 2 years out of date. And then another year, they re-gifted a cellophaned gift basket that had one item removed that was definitely the caviar.
Right, because it had olives and salami.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Amazing. So, and also, the Christmases were awful, apparently, too.
Yeah. Oh,
besides bad gifts.
They were rude to his mother. They spent, like, there was one Christmas Mary recounts where Donald and his brother Robert spent the whole meal berating the mother for cooking beef instead of turkey. First of all, the only right way to celebrate Christmas is with beef. Sorry about it. That's a piece of information from Lila Nordstrom to America. Roast beef is the correct thing to eat for Christmas. Just deal with yourself if you don't agree. That's life. In any case, so they were awful. Apparently, Jared Kushner's father, who, is a convict,
right.
didn't think Ivanka was good enough for Jared and said at the wedding that she had only made herself worthy for inclusion in the family by converting to Judaism. But the passage that Mary writes about that is funny. She says, considering that Charles had been convicted of hiring a prostitute to seduce his brother-in-law, taping their illicit encounter, and then sending the recording to his sister at his nephew's engagement party, I found his condescension a bit out of line. Because Jared's father's case was so funny and so ridiculous.
That's amazing.
For that man to have judgment about anyone is a little much. But also she mentions, and I think this is something that we know, but really, like, I think gives us a window into why Donald Trump is as he is, is that Fred Trump was like a fucking sociopath.
Yeah.
And his brother was abusive, and he was an alcoholic, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred Trump Jr., Mary's father, died of alcoholism in the 90s, or in the 80s, basically. But their mother was nowhere to be found. The father was a sociopath. Everyone was constantly trying to impress Fred Trump, who, as you may remember, is a white supremacist who was one of the most famous abusive landlords and redliners in New York City. And so she also wrote that that, like, you can see in these acquired traits like narcissism and bullying and the grandiosity, the way that he was scarred by, you know, no one loving him basically as a child. And so that is the tragic story of the Trumps.
Oh, and now no one loves him now either.
I know. Well, he is a horrible human being. So earned that.
Mm-hmm. Also a high functioning sociopath.
That's right. He's not that high functioning.
That's true. Yeah.
Fred Trump was more high functioning than Donald. That's one thing. In any case, that's the news this week. Tune in later this week for our Task Force special because
That'll be fun.
That'll be fun, and we're going to have thoughts.
Yeah.
And we will see you then, and we'll see you next week when we talk about the news.
That's right.
Bye.
Bye.